Cases That Change People's Lives, the podcast series, Episode 4 brings to light the significance of a High Court case, the decision of which was overturned in the Supreme Court in 1971. The name of the case was Byrne versus Ireland, the significance of which was that the former prerogative of immunity from suit did not exist in Ireland after the enactment of the Constitution of the Irish Free State in 1922, and therefore was not vested or continued by Articles 49 and 50 of the Constitution of Ireland of 1937. The prerogative of immunity from suit refers to the old principle, the king could do no wrong, meaning that the citizen could not sue the monarch or the state. The commentary in this case is provided by the late Mr. Justice Donal Barrington, who was an esteemed and celebrated constitutional lawyer, who later went on to be a member of the Bench in Ireland, the European Court of Justice, and the Irish Supreme Court. Mr. Justice Barrington had retired when he agreed very happily to become involved in this programme, which he thought was a great idea. He had a great sense of humour, and when he attended in the studio to do the recording, he said, "I do hope that you don't think that I've chosen this case because I'm in it." And of course, nothing could have been further from the truth, because he had such an extensive career, particularly in the area of constitutional challenge. He had, in fact, acted for Mrs. McGee and was also in the DeBerka case. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy his observations and commentary and convey with me our condolences to Mr. Justice Barrington's family and friends for the loss of this wonderful man who died in the early part of 2018. Thank you.
It established for the first time that any citizen could sue the state to defend his constitutional rights and that Ireland was a country governed by law.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of Case Stated. It's my great pleasure this evening to welcome the Honourable Mr. Justice Donal Barrington, retired Chairman of the Bar Council from 1977 to 79, the High Court from 79 to 89, the European Court from 1989 to 96, the Supreme Court from 96 to 2000, and most recently, the President of the Human Rights Commission from 2000 to 2002. You're very welcome, Judge Barrington. It's a great pleasure to have you here this evening. One thing I noted with interest was when I described to you the essential purpose of the programme, that without hesitation, you chose Byrne versus Ireland. And it would be very interesting if you could tell me how it was that this lady, Catherine Byrne, who I'm sure had no idea she was ever going to blaze a trail to the Supreme Court, came to you in the first place.
I hope the only reason I mentioned it wasn't because I was in the case myself. But Kathleen Byrne, the facts of the case are marvellously simple and typically Irish. Kathleen Byrne was a nurse resident in Bray. And officials of the Department of Posts and Telegraphs dug a trench outside her house. She fell in conversation with them. She invited them in and they had cups of tea. And it was a very happy relationship. And then one night she was called out on a late night call. She walked out through her front door and the ground gave way onto her and she fell down and broke her leg. Now, most people would say that is the clearest possible case for an action for compensation for personal injuries. As she goes to her solicitor, they write off to the state, they state the facts, and the state writes back and they offer her her medical expenses, but say there's no question of compensation because the state can do no wrong. And that was a feudal theory inherited and it thought to be part of the law in Ireland. And in retrospect now, it appears ridiculous. But there it was, this unfortunate poor lady was left without compensation. And the purpose of the case was to challenge that theory.
And what were the origins of that theory?
Well, it goes back to medieval times when the king was in power and no one dare challenge his sovereignty. He could do no wrong. In one sense, it was a protection for the citizens, because it could be said that because the king could do no wrong, any officer of the crown who behaved badly could have his head cut off, because he could not have had instructions from the king, whether he had or whether he hadn't. And in that sense, but by the end of the 19th century, it had become a doctrine that you just could not sue the king in the king's court. And that spread not only to Ireland, but to all the countries of the British Commonwealth. And it was an accepted fact of life. Now, in many countries, they changed the law under pressure and introduced legislation giving limited rights to sue the state. In Ireland, by the Road Traffic Act in 1933, if you are knocked down by a vehicle owned by the state, you could sue the Minister for Finance by virtue of the statute. And when we were law students, we were told that if you found yourself on the road and you saw two vehicles approaching you, one was a mechanically propelled vehicle and the other was drawn by a horse, you are much safer to allow yourself to be knocked down by the mechanical propelled vehicle, because you get compensation. If you are knocked down by a dray owned by the Department of Posts and Telegraphs, you could get no compensation, because the king could do no wrong.
So what were your first steps then with Kathleen Byrne? Where did you begin the action?
Well, Joe Tyrrell was the instructing solicitor, and Neil McCarthy and John Cassidy and myself were the counsel in the case. And our first problem was how to formulate the case, because there were practical problems. We had decided we were going to sue the Irish state, but where does it live? What is its registered office? How do you serve a summons upon it? These practical problems. And not only had we the problem of the doctrine that the state had sovereign immunity, but you had the problem, how do you get to the point of starting your action? So we ultimately decided we would serve our writ on the chief state solicitor, and we would name the Attorney General and the state as the defendants. And the chief state solicitor entered an appearance to the case. That is to say, he responded to our summons, but subject to the fact that the state was immune and that this summons was not well founded. And on that basis, a preliminary issue was raised in the case: could you sue the state? And there you had the problem that the king could do no wrong was accepted in Britain and in all the British colonies and throughout the Commonwealth. And here in 1922, it was thought to be accepted, partly because even though the 1922 constitution was in many ways a democratic constitution, nevertheless, the king exercised certain functions. And it was easy to assume that, therefore, the doctrine of sovereign immunity applied in Ireland because of the fact that the king was in the constitution. Mm. But in 1936, by an amendment to the constitution, the king was removed. But still, the doctrine persisted in Ireland. And there were six or seven cases in which the issue might have been relevant. But in every case, counsel on both sides conceded that the doctrine that the king could do no wrong applied in Ireland. And that made it part of the accepted established law.
Oh, yes.
That in many ways was something we had to cope with. In another way, it gave us an escape, because it's an old tradition of the law that what is not argued is not decided. Mm. And therefore, we took the case that we weren't bound by these decisions,
yes,
that the issue was open.
Mm. What judge did you draw in the first round?
Well, we drew George Mernon, who was one of the most able judges on the Irish bench. But he was of the old school, and he didn't believe in fancy constitutional theories. He believed in the black letter of the law. And Tommy Connolly, who incidentally was on the other side in Burn in Ireland, made a marvellous comment about George Mernon. He said that if you gave George the rules of a tennis club to construe, he would construe them better than any lawyer in Ireland, and that was his strength. But his weakness was he thought they were important because they were called rules. And so it was in this particular case. If you read his judgment, you have the analysis of how often the word state appears in the Constitution, when it appears with a large S, when with a small S, when it's equivalent to the territory, when it's equivalent to the political entity called Ireland. And I doubt if there's any other judge who would have taken the trouble to go through the Constitution and parse and analyse it in that way. But the only trouble is he had no concept of the concepts which were involved and the concepts of how you reconcile the authority of the state with the freedom of the citizen.
And how did he express that?
At an early stage in his judgment, he said, the essential question in my decision on this issue is whether the plaintiff can maintain successfully an action for damages against Ireland. The short answer is no.
No.
So that's
not leaving much room for doubt.
The problem. And then he said again at another stage, he said, in my opinion, the state is sovereign in all respects. Now, that refers to the fact that Article 5 of the Constitution says Ireland is a sovereign, independent, democratic state. And what does that mean? We were attempting to argue that it meant that Ireland was externally sovereign in the sense of being independent. It wasn't a colony of any other state. It was an independent state. But that was not inconsistent with its being subject to the discipline of respecting human rights. And that internally, the rights of the citizen had to be vindicated in the courts and reconciled with the authority of the state. Now, George couldn't quite, or didn't quite, grasp that particular point. And he had very strong views. He refers to Tommy Connolly, who was counsel on the other side, and whom, as I said, was the father of constitutional law in Ireland, and who had to present the case on the other side, as every good barrister has to present his client's case as best he can. But he says,
Mr. Connolly asked me to reject out of hand Mr. Barrington's submissions on the construction of Article 49. While I do not accede fully to Mr. Connolly's request, I have to say that during this part of his argument I found Mr. Barrington unconvincing. And on further consideration, I reject his thesis, mainly because, for the reasons I have already given, I reject his submission that the prerogative of immunity from being sued in the courts is inconsistent with the rest of the Constitution. In my opinion, the people who adopted, enacted, and gave to themselves the Constitution, and who in Article 5 laid down that Ireland is a sovereign state, simply meant what is stated in Article 5. The simple statement that Ireland is a sovereign state is completely inconsistent with the propositions that the state is subject to one of the organs of the state, the judicial organ, and can be sued as such in its own courts.
They did state that, but he thought that was the end of story, you know. He had no concept that the Constitution also stated that the state must vindicate the personal rights of the citizen, that it had to respect property, it had to provide primary education, it had to respect the institution of marriage, to look after parents, to protect private property, to guarantee freedom of religion. And he didn't recognise that these must be limitations upon its power. and that if a case arose, there had to be a means whereby the issue between the citizen and the state could be resolved.
Mm.
He seemed to regard these guarantees as kind of meaningless words, which the Oireachtas might attend to, but had no place in the courts, because he had this idea, which came straight from the theory of sovereignty, that the state cannot be sued in its own courts.
Yes.
They were its courts. And why, therefore, should it submit to being sued in them?
Mm. So he came down very heavily against you then, didn't he?
He did, yes. And at the end of the case, when he had delivered judgment against us and awarded costs against my client, he turned to me and he said, I stood up, said, Mr. Barrington, I should like to inform you that your submissions in this case, by their fatuity, have reduced the High Court to the lowest level it has reached in my time on the bench or at the bar.
Good gracious.
And it was probably the greatest insult ever paid to a barrister. And I was virtually on the brink of tears, whereupon a clerk from the Chief State Solicitor's office on the other side of the case came over to me and he said, don't worry, Mr. Barrington, you'll win in the Supreme Court.
Which you did.
Which we did.
Which you did. Yeah. So that was prophetic.
So we went to the Supreme Court, and of course the atmosphere was entirely different, because this was the Odolig Supreme Court, and they were trying Carlo Odolig's policy, enunciated largely by Brian Walsh, was that Ireland was a constitutional republic and that it should look to the United States of America for guidance. Because the English common law system is a great system. Its strength is that it's based on facts. It looks at what happens on the ground. But it lacks concepts of theoretical concepts of justice. It's in danger, therefore, of falling into racialism or prejudice. The 12 men and true may be fine, but they may also be opposed to blacks and to women and to various things like that. But in the United States, they've attempted to superimpose upon the common law a system of values dependent on justice and liberty. And the Odolig Supreme Court was taking the view that the United States was the precedent we should look to see how to reconcile a basically common law country with a system of values derived from a constitution. Now, the problem of this was fine, normally. When I was young at the bar, you asked what the House of Lords decided about X, Y, or Z. But in the Odolig Supreme Court, you're asked, what does the American Supreme Court say about this? And it was a totally different form of values. The problem we were up against in relation to that is that the Americans had adopted the theory of sovereign immunity from the British in the early days. I mean, when they, way back in the 18th century, they had adopted, and this was our major hurdle, because
so that wasn't going to be helpful.
If the greatest republic had adopted it, what were we going on about, you know? And we had great problems with that. But one thing about the Supreme Court in this is that many of the countries of the common law, where the king could do no wrong, prevailed, recognised that there had to be exceptions. And they introduced legislation to create exceptions whereby people could, under certain limited circumstances, sue the state. The British did it with the Pleas of the Crown Act. The Americans did it. And it would have been one of the solutions to our problem in Byrne in Ireland, but our Oireachtas never got around to doing it. And at a certain stage in the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice offered to adjourn the case. We realised that we were on a rising tide at that stage. He offered to adjourn the case if the government would guarantee to introduce legislation to provide compensation for people in the position of Kathleen Byrne and if they'd make the legislation retrospective to ensure that she got her compensation. So we all adjourned on that, and the answer came back from the government, no, they'd prefer to have the issue decided by the court.
It's interesting, was that moving towards a controversial issue as to whether the court should ever be in a position to actually dictate or request that the Oireachtas or the government bring in legislation for something?
Yes, yes. But I mean, there it happened. It was one of the, you won't find it in the law reports, but I can remember it happened because it did happen. And incidentally, another thing which happened, which again there'll be no report of, and which I don't know whether I should refer to or not, but apropos of George having pressed me to say, my position in the case is she must be entitled to compensation. She will get compensation from the state because Ireland is a country governed by law, and if the government doesn't obey the law, then it ceases to be a country governed by law. But he wanted to know, how can you execute it? How can you expect the sheriff to execute a judgment against the state itself?
He put this to you.
He put it to me. And eventually he said, and what about the Attorney General, you see? And I was sufficiently unwise or pressed in a corner, and I said, well, they could always execute against the Attorney General's private property. And when we went to the Supreme Court, this caused great hilarity, you know. And Brian Walsh was saying, well, I suppose, Mr. Barrington, you could seize a picture from the National Museum. And another judge said, or maybe you could seize the Tower of the Chalice, or you could raid the National Library, and so on. And I was sufficiently indiscreet to say, knowing that I was on a rising tide, I said, I believe there's a precedent for seizing the Supreme Court. and that was a bridge too far. The shutters came down and we left that subject and didn't discuss it again.
Your eyes lit up there when you used the expression that you knew you were on a rising tide. As an advocate, that's a pretty high moment.
Yes, yes, of course.
And
yes.
How would you, reflecting on that, how would you say you felt that? I mean, what was that? What were the indications at that stage?
Well, when we were in the High Court, you had no doubt about the fact you're on an ebbing tide. You know? In the Supreme Court, they were so clearly interested in the problem. I mean, there was one dissenting judge, Judge Fitzgerald, but he was dissenting only in the sense that he thought that the Irish state should do what had been done elsewhere, introduce legislation to regulate the circumstances in which the state could be sued. The others, and that may have been why they adjourned to get the opinion of the government.
Yes.
But the others, once they saw that it was an issue of whether this unfortunate woman was denied her compensation because of an archaic principle, they decided to open, in effect, the floodgates and say that any citizen could sue the state.
Let's just get a flavour of that.
If the claim should succeed, judgment would be against the state and not against the Attorney General. It is unnecessary at this juncture to consider how such a decree would be executed or enforced, but it is sufficient to say that an order for mandamus to compel compliance with the judgment would be an appropriate step and not without precedent. For the reasons I have given, the order of the High Court should be reversed, and in lieu thereof, an order should be made answering in the affirmative the question raised in each of the four issues directed to be tried by the order of the 6th of November, 1967.
The thing about the Constitution is it does say that Ireland is a sovereign state. George seized on that and thought that that decides the issue. But it also says the state must vindicate the personal rights of the citizen. Mm. And how do you reconcile those things? What kind of society do you really want to live in? What kind of society did the Constitution mean to create? And ultimately they decided, rightly in my view, that the Constitution wanted to create a society governed by law in which all the citizens could come in and vindicate their rights. Now, the fact that there is no controlling legislation, the Brian Walsh and said in his judgment that he wasn't excluding the fact that the state could regulate the circumstances in which the citizen could come in to sue the state. There's now no control. It's been left wide open. And that's why these cases about the army deafness cases, the blood-polluted cases, and all these cases, everybody can now come in and say, I have been badly treated by the state.
You mentioned a word there. Floodgates, when you said the floodgates opening.
Yes. And
really, the early 70s was like a roller coaster in terms
yes,
of the challenges.
Yeah, that's right.
And I suppose there was then the risk that there would be a feeling that we'd be constitutionalising tort law, that we would be almost looking to the courts to give us rights whenever they didn't exist.
Yeah.
And then there had to be that balancing.
That is
and
true.
And configuring and deciding, well, where would they intervene and how
that
much
is true.
A reflection of society.
It is
would that
a big problem, you know. Mm. But I mean, they were led into a cul-de-sac. I mean, they had no choice but either to adopt the Murnaghan view that the state could do no wrong, or to open the doors and say, we're here to do justice, and we'll listen to anybody who has a complaint, be it against a fellow citizen or against the state. Mm. That's it.
Mm. Quite apart from how distinguished and renowned throughout the world you are in relation to your career so far, every law student who sort of sits there in King's Inn thinking about what lies ahead and reads about all of these cases that you took in the 1970s, this kind of pioneering spirit, I wonder what it was like when you were the other side of the bench, when you saw then this particular principle being stretched, perhaps. Were there times when you were a little impatient?
No, I hope I was never impatient, you know, but I mean, it is a wide, very wide area. And now, of course, I mean, the Constitution, I mean, when I was a young man at the bar, if you quoted the Constitution in court, the judge thought he must have no case. I mean, nobody but a legist would be relying on the Constitution. Mm. Now they rely on the Constitution in every case, largely as a result of another very important case you may wish to consider, the East Donegal case, the livestock marts case, where the Supreme Court held that all discretions exercised by state authorities must be exercised in the light of the Constitution and not otherwise. That has kind of constitutionalised the whole of Irish life. And it's a very significant development. But I must say I'm quite happy with that development.
Mm, you know that expression when they say a lot done, a political motto, I think it is a lot done and more to do. Would you think in the way we're living now that it's all done, that there isn't much more to do for budding lawyers who want to walk in your footsteps?
One could never say that. The world is full of ongoing problems that have never been thought of before. So you can't control the future.
Mm, so the imagination is still open to what the possibilities are. Judge Barrington, it's been an enormous pleasure having you this evening. In a word, when you look back on that choice of that case, what would you say it was about Byrne and Ireland in your own reflections now that was so significant?
Well, I realised it was significant because it raised an issue on whether the citizen had the right to relief in the courts of law, or whether the citizen was dependent upon archaic concepts from another age.
And you broke new ground. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.